I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today's guest is Chris Caudill. He's Associate Professor of Fisheries at the University of Idaho up there in Moscow. We're talking about anadromous lifestyles. Peter, that's going from the ocean back to rivers and back again, and who knows, dealing with salt and fresh water at the same time for a
right.
fish.
Right. I mean, we're not talking about critters that live in brackish water. We're talking about critters who live in part of their lives in freshwater, then saltwater, then freshwater.
They can't make up their mind.
They can't
so
make
good.
Up their mind. I know.
We'll dig into that soon enough. But Peter, first, I bet you've got some nature news for
Absolutely, Leif. When I say the word cicada, what do you think about?
I think about noisy insects that come out of the ground every so often.
Yeah, but you know, today we're going to be talking about some research done by Elio Chalita. He's a bio-inspired roboticist. And when we say cicada, he doesn't think about their noise they make.
What's he thinking?
He thinks about their urine. So it turns out that not all animals pee in the same way.
Go on.
Right. Larger animals rely on gravity and inertia to down the fluids from their bladder, which result in a jet stream. In small animals, such as insects, however, pee doesn't rely or really care about gravity. Instead, it's really about tension and friction resulting in droplets. When we get back down to Mr. Chalita, you would assume that cicadas should pee in droplets. But due to happy circumstances, that is, one of their group got peed on the head by a group of cicadas, they were able to, you know, climb some trees and really get some video of cicadas urinating. And do you know what they found out?
What did they find out?
Cicadas pee in a jet.
Really?
Yeah.
And they're small.
And they're small. So they're breaking all these rules.
Interesting.
And they pee.
Like surface tension, I assume, is one of the big issues there when you're getting
right.
small like
right.
that, right?
So they're not quite for certain, you know, how they can pee in a jet. And the problem, of course, is cicadas are kind of tough to research. You know, they come out every, 7 or 13 years,
yeah,
depending on
like
the
that.
Species.
Yeah.
So it's so important or interesting about these little tiny bugs
right.
peeing in a jet is what you can turn that into, in a sense, for manipulating fluids in the small scale. For instance, robotics, medical research, and a lot of advancements for outer space travel, et cetera.
Okay.
You're going to be looking at these really small components that you need to move fluid through, and somehow the cost effect analysis on cicadas is they're able to pee in jets and it's not costing them a whole lot of energy to do
right,
it.
Right. So we could learn from the cicada.
Right.
You know what I really like about this story is, you know, Isaac Newton famously got bonked on the head from
yeah.
an apple falling from a tree, and these folks
got peed on the head from a cicada.
That's wonderful.
Now, for me, I've been peed on the head by fruit bats, and now I know that it was in droplets.
It was in drops, not
yes,
jets.
Not jets. Yep,
you can
thankfully.
Be thankful for that.
Yeah, yes.
Right. Well, when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking about anadromous fish. So our trivia question, of course, is going to deal with that. What is the most common anadromous fish you can find in the Columbia River Basin? You'll have the answer to that trivia question and so much more when we come back from the break. Chris Caudill joins us to talk all about it. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome today's guest. It's Chris Caudill, and he's the Associate Professor of Fisheries over at the University of Idaho. First off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Well, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
I have been here for a couple of decades and have studied fish migration for most of that time, and more lately have been really interested in using a whole variety of tools from genomics to population modeling to watershed modeling to understand how populations are likely to deal with environmental change, including climate change.
Yeah, so fish migration can be, pretty amazing to think about, especially, inland in Idaho, up the mountains, and we have animals that are transporting themselves all the way down to the ocean and then later on coming back inland to the mountains. It's amazing to think of those kinds of journeys, 800 miles or so, plus elevation. How are they even tracked? Is your sort of science tracking individuals, or you said populations? How is the work done?
That's a great question. And to back up a little bit, in Idaho, we have some of the absolute best Olympic migrants of any animal on the planet. Sockeye salmon and lamprey and Chinook salmon, it makes some of the longest journeys, and it's amazing. When I ask students about it, I talk about, we're here in Moscow in the panhandle of Idaho, and I'm like, so how many of you been to the South Fork? And that's like a 5-hour drive from here. And then I ask folks if they've been to Astoria. That's like a 9-hour drive. And it's like just to get from Astoria to the South Fork driving,
Driving.
where's really wear you out, right? And then to think about the fact that adult salmon are coming back and making that journey over the course of a couple of months without feeding. And then they hold through the entire summertime because their migration is timed to catch the spring flows and allow them to get over rapids and hard places in the river to get by. Then they wait around for a couple of months through the summer before finally spawning and dying. That doesn't even hold a candle to some steelhead that come in the fall and wait through the entire winter before starting to spawn about this time of year. Pacific lamprey actually do the same thing, but they start in May, so they start migrating now, and they won't start spawning until a full year later, and have even been documented spawning 2 years after coming in. And so, how have we learned some of these things? A lot of it has had to do with tagging individual fish. In the early days, it was tag individuals with just a metallic tag and watch for them to come back. It's one of the ways we learned that salmon and steelhead home, or they're phylopatris, meaning they have a love of place, so they come right back to where they were spawned. More recently, we've been able to really track their movements in really fine detail with what are called passive integrated transponder tags, which are the same thing, the microchips you put in your pets. And those have a little transponder that have to go through an antenna that sends out energy that actually charges up that little transponder and makes it go ping. And that same antenna listens for it as it goes by in places like antenna arrays that span river bottoms or are located in dams along the Columbia River. And then there are a couple of research vessels that drag a big net that funnels fish down through the net and doesn't capture them, but runs them through an antenna and detects them in the estuary out in the Columbia River estuary near the ocean. As adults come back, we've learned an awful lot about them by inserting what are called active tags that have a battery that actively go ping in some way, either by transmitting a radio signal or by transmitting an acoustic signal through the water. Kind of like a sonar signal. And those tags, you have to have a receiver some distance away from them. A radio tag you can detect from as much as a couple miles away, either with an antenna that's in the water or from an antenna outside the water that it can even be in an airplane. And so those kinds of tags have been used really with some frequency since the early 90s. And in fact, I came here 5 or 7 years into a large radio telemetry program started by Ted Bjorn in the early 90s. The very first tagging really got underway in the late 90s. And so, by having radio antennas at a bunch of locations around dams and at tributary mouths, we were able to track the individual migration histories of, over the course of several decades, more than 20,000 individual fish to understand how they responded to dams and fish ladders and fishways. How they responded to the operations of those reservoirs and those dams, and to learn quite a bit about their biology and their ultimate fate after they were passing those dams. More recently, we've added more instrumentation to those tags. And so we were able to do a study recently that had basically Fitbits in those radio tags. And steelhead, they come back this time of year to spawn. And one of the things that's really hard to know for steelhead is exactly where and when they spawn, because the rivers are full of snowmelt runoff and you can't see them like you can in the fall with a species like Chinook. You can't do what are called red counts, where you go and you count the number of reds that they have. And so we put these radio tags that had accelerometers in them and basically kind of counted steps for steelhead. And we could basically build activity budgets. We knew when they were loafing on the couch, when females were digging those nests, and then we could even tell when they were mating by when they were spawning, because they showed different acceleration histories, kind of the same way we do with our Fitbits.
How many years does
Yeah.
it take from spawning out to the ocean and back again for the salmon?
Yeah, so in salmon, it varies from fish that migrate from freshwater to the ocean just before their first birthday. Most Chinook salmon in Idaho migrate after their first birthday, so they're 1 year olds. And then most steelhead migrate when they're 2 to 3 years old. Then we count the years in the ocean as ocean years, basically. And so a one ocean fish would be a fish that spent 1 year in the ocean before it came back. Most Chinook salmon that come back are two ocean fish, and some of the biggest ones are three ocean fish. And so Chinook salmon that come back will have, when they spawn, there'll be a total of, on average, mostly 4 year olds. Some will be 3 year olds, some will be 5 year olds, and some might even be 6 years old. In steelhead, they usually are one ocean fish, and at least in Idaho, those are called the A run fish. They're the smaller one ocean fish, and then the famous sort of B run fish come in a little later, and they've spent 2 years in the ocean, and so they get to be quite a lot larger. Lamprey, back to how we've learned about these things, one of the absolutely coolest studies that's come out in the last little while, and technologies that's just being developed, is what's called parentage-based tagging. And that's basically where you take a fin clip of a fish before it spawns, and then if you can collect enough of those fish, you basically get DNA fingerprints from all of the adult fish that spawn in a particular place. And then in their offspring, you can DNA fingerprint them. And just like 23andMe figures out who the parents were and where those offspring came back. And so the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission and Idaho Fish and Game and several agencies have started collecting those fin clips over the last decade and developing basically DNA databases. At basically any hatchery fish in Idaho that comes back, if you clip its fin and do these genetic analyses, you can find out who its parents were, which hatchery it was spawned at, and exactly how old it is, which is a really cool management tool. Pacific lamprey have been really hard to know much about their life cycle because the larvae go out, they look kind of like they're a little bit smaller than a gummy worm when they go out, and so they're too small to tag when they go out to the ocean. And unlike salmon, they don't home with nearly the same precision when they come back to fresh water. We're still learning about that. A group of several tribes for a little over a decade have been collecting fish at the dams on the Columbia River and transporting them around the dams and releasing them to tributaries that had previously had lamprey but had lost those populations with the building of the dams. And they took fin clips of all those fish. And so just in the last year, it's been shown that those fish that were translocated have been producing offspring, that those offspring could be detected in the mainstem Columbia River on their way to the ocean. Some were even found way out in the ocean off the coast, I think, of Russia, and that some of those fish have actually returned as adults to the Columbia Basin.
That's
And
impressive.
we used to think that they spent 3 to 5 years in freshwater as larvae, but those tagging programs have shown that they can be in freshwater for as long as 10 years.
That's fantastic. So our tracking has gotten a whole lot more sophisticated to be able to reveal the, I don't know, the life stages, life cycle, and patterns of where these animals are. I'm curious if it's very well understood. You know, the advantages of being, I see it as a cost benefit of being an anadromous fish, that lifestyle. Obviously, there's a big trek involved, a big investment of time and energy. So the benefit must be great. for these animals to make this migration. What's our current understanding of that cost benefit, the benefit especially?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great question. And in fact, there's a PhD student here who's doing prelims and got that almost exact same question from me. So I should let him.
Now it's your turn to answer it.
Yeah. The theoretical framework that has been applied to that question is exactly that cost-benefit analysis. And a lot of the evidence really suggests that natural selection in the past, in the conditions of the past, has led to the evolution of either anadromous life cycles, which means running up, where the adults run up into fresh water, or catadromous life cycles, where the adults run downstream and spawn in the ocean, downrunning. And only about 1% of fish have that kind of life cycle, but they're disproportionately important to human societies because they're usually highly productive and they deliver a lot of protein to human systems, right? Salmon being the obvious example from the Pacific Northwest. If we look across a whole bunch of different species, it's pretty clear that it seems like that is the big advantage. If you can get to, in the Pacific Northwest, get to the ocean, that's much more productive. And instead of being a rainbow trout that after 4 or 5 years is maybe a foot in most Idaho streams that are relatively nutrient poor, a B-run steelhead can go to the ocean in that same time and grow to 10 to 30 pounds. A couple of lines of evidence that are really interesting that kind of support this idea is in steelhead, unlike the other Pacific salmons, can spawn multiple times, whereas salmon famously spawn once and die. And that's called similparity. Steelhead in Idaho tend to be functionally similparous. Very, very few make it back on second spawning trips, about 1% to 3%. If you go down to the Oregon coast, those steelhead populations, about 1 in 5 steelhead are able to come back for a second spawning run. And so that really clearly illustrates the fact that these populations have different costs to their migration. One of the coolest studies looking across all anadromous and catadromous fishes asked the same question. And a very cool pattern that came out is that in the temperate region, anadromy is much more common. And in the tropics, catadromy is much more common. The explanation for that, that's sort of the best understood, is that tropical marine habitats tend to be unproductive, right? That's why we go there to sit on white sand beaches and look at the crystal blue waters. And fresh waters tend to be more productive than those tropical marine waters. And so there, catadromy is the life cycle that provides that better cost-benefit analysis. As a total aside, Sigmund Freud's first job was to search for the gonads of European eels, because since Aristotle's time, Aristotle hypothesized that American or European, he was studying European eels, they're closely related, arose from spontaneous generation from earthworms. Because in the migration season, all of a sudden, adult eels just start running down the river and can be caught in nets. And where they came from was completely unknown. They seem to just arise from the muck in swamps, because that catadromous life cycle, they swim upstream as very small eels, smaller than a pencil. They're called glass eels. And they live in freshwater for 5 to 10 years, growing into adults before swimming all the way to the Sargasso Sea, which is out kind of in the middle of the Southwest Atlantic, spawn there, and then ride the Gulf Stream all the way back up as larvae over the course of more than a year before coming back into freshwater.
The things we didn't know back then.
Right.
Yeah. And so I sort of joked that Sigmund Freud's, that was his first job, was looking for gonads in eels and couldn't find them, and then went on to other things in science.
Yeah, right.
Bigger, better things.
Bigger, better.
So I have a question with the salmon. They're going out to the ocean for 1, 2, 3 years. And even within a 1 year time frame, you can see there's the potential for significant change within a river system, whether, you know, man-made, you know, natural disaster, flooding, et cetera. So when these fish come back, what happens to them if there's some type of change within that system?
That's a great question. And so, again, back to, you know, if we think way back during the Ice Age, there were no salmon in Idaho. And they've been able to recolonize through what's called straying, which is kind of the opposite of homing, where fish naturally have a sort of a mistake rate in returning back home. The way salmon, once they reach fresh water, the primary way they find their spawning habitat is by taking left, right turns based on the smells, the olfactory signals coming out of those rivers. And I think of this as like different flavors of tea in the different tributaries as they come upstream. And so they'll swim back and forth across the channel. And as they approach a confluence, they'll have a memory of what that smelled like as they were swimming past that as a juvenile, and remember the sequence of those odorants, right? And so they'll make left, right turns and get right back to where they were, unless something like, you know, Mount St. Helens goes off and all of a sudden it's volcanic ash, and then they'll make different choices. And so that natural sort of background rate has allowed them to colonize new habitat, to exchange genes across populations, and also become very locally adapted at the same time. So there's this sort of tension between natural selection tuning populations to the exact conditions in a watershed, and having strays come in, bring in new genes, and then having conditions change in that watershed and have that straying allow populations to come in and persist. And that dynamic is called a metapopulation dynamic in biology geekery speak.
It reminds me of trait variation allowing for a range of outcomes within a population so that change can happen over time.
Yes, and it's sort of a portfolio effect if you think about the populations in a watershed, because some of them will have different genetics, but they're still exchanging it. And as conditions change, that allows those populations to pull in some of those genes and persist or completely recolonize or move around as conditions change.
So we're talking about what if a waterway changes year for year or within the life cycle of an individual animal. So now let's superimpose that in the bigger scale of since historic times and humans have been acting on the land and changing waterways in a variety of ways, and also climate shifts over time and the amount of water coming into the system or the temperature available in waterways or the riparian habitat along waterways changes over time, right? What do we know, I guess, about populations of fish that are doing these migrations? Obviously, dams is one type of obstacle that they might face along that migration route. What's our current understanding about that?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the clear things that's happened in the Pacific Northwest is that salmon have declined precipitously. They're now at about 5 or 10% of their historic abundances. And those declines are often attributed to the so-called four H's: hydro, basically dams, habitat change, including logging and grazing and those kinds of changes, harvest, including commercial fisheries in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and then the effects of hatcheries causing changes in the genetics of fish, particularly before we got a little more sophisticated about how we choose stocks. And then in the last couple of years, we've really come to understand that sort of a lot of the fluctuations in salmon populations is driven by changes in climate from year to year, like you were just talking about. And so one of the big open questions, you know, one of the big questions for the last half century of salmon biology in the Pacific Northwest is how do the 4-H's impact fish? How can we ameliorate those changes to keep salmon on the landscape? And now one of the really great open questions is how well will salmon be able to track and adapt and move those populations around in the ways we were just talking about to be able to track climate change impacts on top of these other four kinds of impacts? Which populations will be able to do that? Which populations may not be able to do that? And what additional steps will we have to take to keep salmon on the landscape?
Sounds complicated, right? There aren't easy solutions here, right?
No, if you think about the jurisdictions that an individual salmon, legal jurisdictions that a salmon right. swims through, that's a whole lot different than a rainbow trout in a pond.
Well, and each of these life histories and animals have different trajectories, as you were describing, you know, early on in the interview. There's quite a lot of variation in timing within the season, duration that they'll spend at sea before they come back inland. And if we're trying to preserve some amount of population, viable population within the landscape, there's a lot of considerations, I guess, that humans can have in controlling the success or non-success, I guess, of those migrations.
Yeah, and one of the really important things for salmon is to have, one of the ways I think about this is a seasonal windows of opportunity to migrate up or downstream. And salmon show a lot of diversity in when they will attempt those migrations, because those change depending on where you are and what has happened in the past in terms of seasonal cycles. And so really maintaining that diversity of life histories is really important to having an overall portfolio of life histories that allows population stability and persistence in the future. It's an analogy that's been demonstrated in actually salmon populations and applied to other ecological populations. And it comes straight out of the financial world, where you want to, if you want to keep a nice stable bank balance, you have a portfolio of investments that if some go down, others might go up and keep you from losing sleep at night.
Right? I like it. Well, I really appreciate this conversation about fish lifestyles, a lot of things I hadn't really considered before. So I really do appreciate it. We had a trivia question that I'd like to return to. What is the most common anadromous fish in the Columbia River Basin?
For better or worse, it's the American shad, which is an anadromous species from the East Coast, native to the East Coast. John McPhee wrote an entire book examining the legend that shad swam up the Delaware River and saved Washington's troops at Valley Forge, and but made a semi-compelling case that the big shad migrations early in the colonial history of America were an important food source and resource. They were introduced in the 1880s in the Sacramento River, and they've naturally colonized the Columbia Basin, and now between 3 and probably 10 million come back to the Columbia River. As many as 7 million have passed Bonneville Dam. So it's a very large component of the ecosystem that we don't understand very well. And they may have positive benefits for being, say, a prey base for young salmon while they're in the ocean. But there's also concern that they may do things like subsidize predators like double-crested cormorants and Caspian terns in the lower Columbia River. So there are more of those birds around waiting for when the smolts pass, trying to get to the ocean.
East Coast shad, I tell you. Well, Chris, we really want to thank you for joining us today. And for our listeners, if you really want to learn more about the salmon and lamprey, please visit and Google the Fish Ecology Research Lab at the University of Idaho. You know, this is not the first time we've interviewed folks from University of Idaho. They're doing really cool stuff over there. So go and look. Thank you, Chris.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at Idaho State University with editing and production by Jamin Anderson. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.